like the kind of energies that are now probed in LHC, Large Hadron Collider. If you don't want to go to that high energy, but you're more limited to astrophysical processes of what happens in centers of the stars, then this phenomenological description is reasonable, although not exact. So, I mean, as you know, so everything is made out of quarks and leptons at the fundamental level. So a proton is made out of how many quarks? Three quarks. So what are they? Up, down, right? So up, and one down is a proton. Right. And then a neutron, is up, down, down. So this has the charge of 2/3. So it's minus 2/3, minus 1/3, right? And so this would be neutral. This would be plus 1. So let's see. Right. So and the interactions would be true gluons. So you have basically three messengers for forces. You have gluons, which are for what force? Strong force. We have a weak force, which is true W plus minus Z boson. And then there is electromagnetic force, which is true photons. So we've already talked quite a bit about electromagnetic force and interactions that, and of course there is gravity, if you will. And that's, I guess, graviton, right? Graviton. So this is, of course, this is more hypothetical. We don't really know whether gravitons exist as fundamental particles. These three have been confirmed. We talked quite a bit about photons, electromagnetic interactions, and gravitational interactions as at the classical level. Well, electromagnetic at both classical and quantum level, gravity at the classical level, since, as you know, quantum gravity is still a big area of research and still not established. So strong and weak forces are a realm of nuclear interactions. That's what we're going to discuss today. And it's kind of interesting that both of them are, I mean, they're in the opposite limits. Strong is stronger than all the four forces. Weak is weaker than at least the three forces. It's not quite as weak as gravity. But nevertheless, on larger scales, you don't see either of these. On larger scales, you only see electromagnetic force. So why do you think on larger scale we don't see weak force and a strong force? Okay, so for, let's start with a strong force. Why wouldn't we see a strong force on larger scale?
There's some characteristic interaction scale.
For a strong forces? Yeah. Where does that come from? Why is there a characteristic scale? Gluons are massless, so they're not heavy.
Is it because gluons have color, and so they can't exist within a certain range because of color conservation?
Well, you could have mass conservation and still see gravity at large distances. Okay, so let me give you a hint. So it's actually very similar to what we were discussing about why plasmas are neutral. Right, exactly. So that's the thing. The idea is that if it's a strong enough force, then it basically acts, and there's nothing that it could oppose it, then it's going to basically neutralize itself. So there are colors that cause the strong forces, basically charge or source of strong forces. But if if there's a large force, then there would be large acceleration. So the system would evolve until it comes to equilibrium. So basically, it should screen itself if there is no other force that could contract it. And that's exactly the same way with electromagnetic force when gravity, because the electromagnetic force is so much stronger than gravity, nothing can oppose it. So basically, it has to shield itself eventually. That's why the plasmas that we deal with are neutral, because the electromagnetic force is much stronger than gravity. The same happens for a strong versus these other forces. It's a very similar situation. A strong is several orders of magnitude stronger than, well, depending on how you count, either two or four orders of magnitude stronger than electromagnetic force, and electromagnetic force is still stronger than weak force. So basically what happens is you can only have color neutral particles. So this, the reason that the objects that you see, like protons or neutrons, they are color neutral is the same reason that plasmas are neutral, is that the forces are so strong that if they were neutral, they would be basically, there would be this large force that would, nothing could stop it, so they, it would shield itself. So it's self-shielding. So it's kind of, it's interesting. So that's very different from the reason that you don't see so short range, let's see, do self-shielding. So, because this is short range, this is short range. Because of self-shielding. So what do you think it's, WZ are short range?
They're massive.
That's right. So they are massive particles. So yeah, so they decay exponentially. So these are. So this is also similar. So this is much more like a Debye length in some sense. The effect, the reason that you don't see gluons because of the self-shielding. This is more simple. It's the weak effect. It doesn't involve a strong coupling. It's just the fact that the force doesn't go very far. Massive, gauge bosons. Okay, so these two forces are short range because of this. So at low energies, that's why we don't talk about quarks and gluons, because as I said, quarks come in these packages that are color neutral, and gluons come in, gluons don't, you don't have basic sources for gluons because the color is, there is no color, right? These are color neutral. So the only thing that could happen is similar to basically dipole interactions, like when you have molecules, right? So they don't have charges, but they could they would have like van der Waals forces when they get close to each other. And the same thing is there are contact interactions or very close by interactions when these particles, when protons and neutrons get close to each other. So this leads to some effective model for protons and neutrons as long as you are in this regime that basically gluons have self-shielded, so your energies aren't high enough to actually probe individual quarks. You can basically talk about an effective theory for neutrons and protons that sit in a nucleus. So a nucleus, they would be made out of protons and neutrons. And this is really an effective theory, neutron, proton, let's say. And this is an example of an effective theory, or effective field theory. Because the particles that we're talking about are not fundamental particles, but the same way that molecules and atoms are not fundamental particles. But as long as you're talking about things that are much larger than the size of these guys, then you could just consider them as fundamental particles. So there is a simple description for energetics of this water. Well, I think it has a name. What is the name? I forgot. Something bag. The name escapes me. I want to say water bag, but yeah, I don't remember the. Oh, droplet model. Sorry. Well, I guess droplet is a water bag. Yeah. So there is a droplet model. So the droplet model is idea that nucleus is like a droplet made out of nucleons, and it has a constant density. So this is an incompressible fluid. Nuclear fluid is an incompressible fluid. And that has to do with basically what we were saying, the same, more or less the same way that you think why water is incompressible. It's that it's made out of these molecules. They cannot get too close to each other. They start basically repelling each other if they get too close to each other. And if they are if they get far enough, far from each other, they don't see each other. So that's why whenever you have short-range interactions, you can think of this, and particles get close to each other, you can think of it as a fluid or near incompressible fluid. So the droplet model, the parameters is atomic weight, A, which is the number of nucleons, and Z, which is atomic number, it's the number of protons, number of neutrons plus protons. This is number of protons. And let's see what else. And there is atomic mass. Let's say atomic mass, MCS squared, which is A minus Z times mass of neutron plus Z times mass of proton minus A E bar of B, where basically this is the binding energy per nucleon. This is just a definition of E bar B, basically. Binding energy. Per nucleon. So how many of you have already seen this droplet model? You think I've seen it? Maybe. Yeah. So this is not in a particle physics. This is a nuclear physics course, probably. You might have seen it. Or it could be in a modern physics course, in fact. Trying to remember where I saw this. Yeah. Right. So it's very simplistic. So far, I've only given you definitions. So this is just the energy of a nucleus, and you could just define it as the mass, rest mass of neutrons, neutrons times the number of neutrons, rest mass of protons times the number of protons. I guess I should put CS squared here as well if I want to. And then whatever left is whatever else is left is just the interaction energy, and you can just call it interaction energy per nucleon. That would be E bar B. Right. So there is an empirical fit to this. Basically, what you can do is you can go out, measure the mass of different nuclei. I mean, atoms, most of their mass is in their nuclei. So you can just go out and measure the mass of these. And of course, for different isotopes, you know, you can, I mean, there are different ways of measuring A and Z independently. Well, Z is the charge. And of course, A is minus Z is basically the mass. So these are all the small corrections, I should say. So this E bar B is of order mega electron volt, several mega electron volt. This mass is of order what? Giga electron volt, right? So these are 1,000 times bigger than this. So the empirical formula, which is really just an empirical fit with some physical story behind it, something that looks like this, is some mass, and it's mass of nucleon. I'm not quite sure. I guess it's mass of neutron. I'm not sure. I think that's what it is. B1a plus B2a to the 2/3 minus B3z plus B4a times 1/2 z over a squared plus B5 squared divided by a. 1/3, and these numbers, you can look them up online. I'm not going to write them. So these are just numbers that you can just fit. If you fit to the atomic or nuclear data, you can find these numbers. These are fine, the five just fitting. That you can, it's five fitting numbers. So let me just ask you then, what do you think the meaning of these terms are? So this first and third term must be easy. What are these? Right, so those are just these two terms, right? The terms that are linear. So what do you think this term is? Given that it's an incompressible fluid and it has, the idea is that there's a fixed density, which is nuclear density for this. Sorry, let's see, nuclear is 1.4 times 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. So it's 14 orders of magnitude denser than water. Right. So what do you think is this term? Pressure? Okay. Why? Right, so this is given that it's incompressible, so this goes as the volume, right, because A is the mass, basically. So this goes, and it's compressible, so mass is the same as volume. So this goes as what, just geometrically? Okay, so based on that, what do you think is the surface? So that's I think that's more reasonable interpretation. So these two, we just decided they are rest mass. Or nucleon rest mass. So this goes as area. And so this again comes back to our intuition for short-range forces. A liquid is made out of particles or atoms or molecules that have short-range interactions. So essentially, every particle in a fluid has a number of neighbors, and the interactions energy are just contact energy. So you just count the number of neighbors. Except for the guys who live at the surface, so they're missing half of their neighbors or something like that. So the total energy, if it's just contact interactions, there would be some constant per nucleon. And that constant, you could absorb it in this B1 or B3. Except for the guys who sit at the surface who are missing half of their neighbors. So they're missing half of their contact interaction. So that's the idea of surface tension. And that's so if these are attracting each other, of course, the reason you have a nucleus is that these guys want to sit next to each other. This is going to be positive because you want to minimize the surface, right? So basically, let's say if I kind of elongate this, it's a longer surface. That means that the guys are farther away from each other. There are more of these guys who are missing their neighbors. So you want to minimize, if you want to minimize minimize the energy, that means the guys, they're going to be close to us, these want to have as many neighbors as possible, all of these, then that means that it must be, the surface tension must be positive term. Does that make sense? So you want to minimize the surface, that means you want to minimize the number of particles who are missing their neighbors. So this is surface tension. And it's really exactly the same reason you have surface tension, say, for a water droplet, which is the reason for this, for the name. So let's go with this guy. So what do you think this term is for? It's called a Z squared divided by A to the 1/3. Good, good. And of course, the protons are charged. So it goes as the square of, okay. A is that's the size, okay. So what sort of energy is this? Electrical energy. So I could say electrostatic energy. Good. And so these are all very simple. And the last one that's a little bit more subtle, it's basically minimized when the number of protons and neutrons are the same. Otherwise, it's it's not non-zero. So the more offset you have between the number of protons and neutrons, the bigger this term is. So what do you think is the interpretation of this? Well, I mean, everything here except for the linear terms is binding energy by definition. Okay, but why? So that's the meaning of this term. If you have many more neutrons than protons or vice versa, then yeah, so that's actually so something important. Good. So neutrons can actually become protons and vice versa, and that's called the beta decay. So do I have this exactly somewhere? So beta decay is neutron going to. So you go to proton plus electron plus, I believe, an antineutrino. I haven't screwed this. Yep. Had it somewhere. But yeah, so that's what happens. So this could happen or so neutrons, if you actually have a free neutron, this is what's going to happen. If you just have a neutron in this room, after something around 10 minutes, it's going to decay to a proton plus an electron plus an antineutrino. But the reverse could also happen. The proton could capture an electron and become a new. So we could have also proton plus electron become a neutron plus a neutrino. All right. Yep. So this can happen. Protons can actually they can, and this is through weak interactions. This is known as a beta decay. This also can happen inside an isotope. Inside an isotope, you could have a neutron that becomes a proton. And of course, and different isotopes, they have the same Z, but they have different A's. So you could, in principle, have different combinations of A's and Z's. It's just that some of them would be more stable than others. And this, at least, if it was just due to this term, the ones that have Z closer to half of A, that means similar number of neutrons and protons, they would be more stable. That means that you prefer to, if you have too many neutrons, neutrons prefer to decay to proton plus electrons and neutrinos. Or if you have too many protons, protons prefer to capture an electron from somewhere if they are available. And so these are known as electron capture. So if it's in an atom, proton can, through quantum tunneling, can capture one of the electrons and become a neutron.
Does the proton capture more energetic than the neutron
decay? So it's favorable for neutron. Protons are obviously stable. It is possible for them to capture an electron and make a neutron, but of course neutron eventually will decay unless it's inside the nucleus. But if you have a free neutron, it will eventually decay. So both of these could happen in thermal equilibrium, right? If you have enough electrons. But in isolation, you tend to make basically everything will eventually decay to protons and electrons.
So that maybe explains why we see most atoms have.
Good. But we still haven't decided why.
Right.
But they're close. So it turns out, I mean, there are all these other terms, right? But this term would like you to have this comparable, almost the same number of neutrons. So why do you think, any suggestions? So it has to do with Pauli exclusion principle. So what happens is if you have, so the same way that if you have a metal and you want to put electrons in it, so there are a certain number of energies that the electron can sit in. Or if you have an atom and you want to put electrons in, so like a helium atom or any other atom in the periodic table. Because fermions cannot occupy the same states, you have to basically put that you can have two fermions or two electrons, one spin up, one spin down, per state. The same is true for atom. So there are basically certain energy states, right? And these are almost the same for electrons and protons because they all have the same nuclear reactions. Of course, protons have electrostatic reaction, but that's a long range force, so that changes things a little bit for protons. That's this term, but not too much. So the main thing is the nuclear reactions that give you these states. So, so the thing is that you can have one or two, I guess if these are fermions, spin 1/2 particles, there are two spins, a spin up and a spin down. So you have to get two neutrons per state, say, a spin up, a spin down, a spin up, and then two protons per state. So you can see then, if I have too many neutrons, then on average energy is going to be bigger. It's basically the same reason that if you have a bucket of water, it's going to be level, this side of the bucket and the other side of it have the same height. This is exactly the same thing here. If I have too many neutrons, then I have excess energy because of the Fermi degeneracy pressure, or Fermi, Pauli exclusion principle, I should say. So basically the way to minimize the energy is to convert these neutrons to protons, and then they could occupy the same space because of different particle now. So that's responsible for this term.
So if we somehow lived in a world where the proton was also neutral, we would basically expect that minus z over h disappear.
Right, exactly. So this is plus, by the way. So this is positive. So yeah, if you don't have electric.
Oh yeah, like.
Right. Well, I don't know. It's problems or features, different ways of thinking about it. Where is this clock? Okay, good. So this is the idea of, this is the Pauli exclusion principle. Where do I put it? So this term is due to Pauli exclusion principle. And of course, these are all rough ideas. None of these are exact. And for example, these states aren't exactly the same for neutrons and protons because protons are charged. But so basically, that's the kind of the underlying basis for this fitting formula. At the end of the day, you just go and fit for this form, these p's, and then you get something that works rather well, as it turns out. So now you can plot this and see basically the binding energy, which is basically everything except for these linear terms divided by A. You can plot the binding energy, EB. Of course, EB should be negative, otherwise these guys wouldn't want to sit next to each other. They would just fly apart. So if something is bound together, any bounded state needs to have negative, but energy needs to be less than the energy if the particles were separate. So that's why I put a negative here. So if you draw binding energy using this formula, or actually using real data, if you will, as a function of A, and this, we could do it for the most stable isotopes. I guess it could be different Zs. But as I said, Z is close to A, as it turns out. So you get something that looks like this. I guess not quite as steep. So it's not really a curve, because this is a discrete number. So there are a bunch of points. I'm just drawing a line that connects them. But at large A's, it becomes more or less continuous, less jagged. So there is a peak at A of 56, which happens to be the most stable isotope of iron. I guess Z is half of that, right? Which is, what is Z for iron? Anybody? Justin, you always are very handy with. No, for iron, Z is, I think it should be like half 25, 28. Is that right? Yeah. Right, I don't have it. I haven't written it down here. And like, obviously, my chemistry is not very reliable. OK, well, we can figure it out. But based on this formula, it should be around, it should be 28. Well, or close to it. I mean, obviously, this could change by one or two because, I mean, there are all these other terms. And let's see. So can you tell which term is responsible? So this EB is, so if AB is maximum, this means it's the most stable element. That means that the energy is M is, M per nucleon is minimized. 26? Is it? Okay. Atomic number is 56.
Atomic number is generally.
Oh, did I? Oh, atomic. Right. Atomic number is 26, right. I mean, the A is atomic mass. So right. Okay, so good. Okay, so it's close to 28, but not quite, right? Half of 56 is 28, right? Half of 56 is 28. Okay. So it's a little bit more neutrons. Well, atomic mass, atomic weight, the same thing. Did I call it atomic? Yeah, atomic weight, sorry, yeah. Well, I guess technically it's the mass, it's not the weight, right? As we all know. But these are just masses of convention. So, good. So can you tell me then what's responsible? So which of these, given that Z is of close to A, which of these terms dominate for large A? The electrostatic, and how would that go? How would it scale with A?
Well, that's approximately
A over 2, so 5/3. 5/3? Okay, so then if I divide by another A is A to the 2/3, so this is decreasing like minus, it's like minus A to the 2/3. It's plus here, but then in EB, I'm dividing by A and there's an extra minus sign. And at a small A's, what term dominates EB? Right. Okay, which one is it? No, the electrostatic was this one. This is electrostatic. Electrostatic. Right? Because here is plus, but then, yeah, in the definition of EB, this is per nucleon and there's a minus sign. Good, so surface tension. So surface tension is, if I divide by A, that goes as A to the is one, A to the minus 1/3. Does that add up? It's a little bit confusing. But does that make sense? A to the minus 1/3? Hmm? We divide this by A. Right. So you take away the linear terms, which are these guys, and then divide everything by A, and then with an extra minus sign, that gives you EB. Okay. Well, but if right, so this is independent in a sense. If you first minimize this, it just gives you Z equal to A, so that just becomes zero, right? Right. So if you just take this formula as it, well, I mean it's actually not quite true because there's Z appearing in other one places as well. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So let's see what these are. So this is, I mean, physically this makes sense. Right? So if you have a very big, there is this Z squared here. So if you have a very big nucleus, there are lots of protons in it, and so there's a large electrostatic repulsion goes as the number of protons. So it's going to be hard to add another proton because it goes as charge. Divided by radius, but radius goes only as A to the 1/3, right? Or, well, the force would be A to the 2/3, because goes as 1/r squared. But it's still, the larger the larger nucleus, the harder it's going to be to add protons to it. And here, it's the surface tension that dominates, because this has the lowest power of A. And what it's telling you is, basically, particles want to have as many neighbors as possible. So it's instead of having a lot of tiny nuclei, you prefer to have one big nucleus where you have as many neighbors, nucleons are surrounded by as many neighbors as possible. Right. I mean, if you go to very small A, of course, this becomes jagged. And yeah, so this is not a very good fit, right? But so good. So do all this make sense? Okay. Yeah. So, right.
Yeah, at low A, the poly term just generally goes away if you get it.
Right. So this term, if you say this term is at low A is a small, if you ignore this term, and these terms have already taken away because in the definition of winding mass, that's not. So then you just have this term, and if you want to minimize it, the minimum is when it vanishes, basically, right? So then you just get Z equal to A. Right. Okay. Good.
Sure.
Right. Of course, it's the sum number minus A to the 2/3, right? And the same is the sum number minus A. Right. So, right. Is that right? This is, of course, positive. No. Right, let me see. This is positive. These are all positive, but there's a constant that comes somewhere, I guess, from somewhere. Where does it come from?
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just write it again. So E binding, this is the definition of binding energy, is M minus A minus Z times MN minus ZMP divided by A, and there's a minus sign. So this is total energy minus the individual particle energies divided by the total number of nucleons.
Yeah, and then you have our M there.
Right. Yeah, so the point is that there is some constant that comes at this maximum. There is some maximum. As you go to the small a's, this term dominates and tries to make this binding energy smaller because you don't like the surface tension term. It doesn't like particles to be far apart. They want them to be all to stick together. If you go to high A, then the electrostatic energy becomes big because particles are repelled. So this is why, so this is what's important about in astrophysics in particular, because if everything is equal, if nucleons had a choice of picking which nucleus they want to sit in, they would prefer to sit in iron. And this is basically this is very important in the evolution of in supernova explosion, basically, right?
Exactly.
Well, if they could, you mean at this point or right? Exactly. Exactly. That's kind of everything balances.
So
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. And this is this is where nuclear fusion happens. Basically, if you have large enough temperatures that atoms can actually, or nucleon can actually combine together, they would prefer to be together to be something as heavy as iron. If you have a very large nucleus and you somehow manage to make them, so it's not easy to make these guys because, of course, it's not favorable. But it turns out if very high energies, I mean, the same way that this could go both ways, everything can happen at very high energies. So you can, in principle, make things that are heavier than iron in supernova explosions. But then what happens that they prefer to go down here to the choice. So that's when basically fission happens. That if there is enough energy, these guys, so basically the idea is that there are local minima. Every atom, has every nucleus is locally stable. But if you could perturb it enough, it would prefer to go basically become something like iron. So this would be fission, and it would release energy basically when it happens. So this is how nuclear bombs work. This is how central stars work, right? Good. So let's see. So this is right. So in particular, this is important because what happens at the centers of the stars, and I guess this is going. I think one of your assignments, maybe the last assignment, is about this: is that you start from hydrogen, you make helium, you make carbon, you make basically all these elements, and at some point it's going to stop if you have a low mass star because of the degeneracy pressure. It cannot collapse anymore. It doesn't get any hotter than that. But for very big stars, at some point you're going to make iron, and then there is nothing that basically you can make to stop it. And so that's going to be a runaway process. Basically, everything is going to collapse. That's how you make but then happens that either the whole star explodes because there's nothing that can stop it, or you make central part collapses, makes a black hole, and the outer parts explodes and makes a supernova. So this is important for basically supernova explosions. This peak is the reason you have supernova explosions, basically. Although I should say, so these are so-called core collapse supernovae. For smaller stars, you don't make it all the way because you need high enough temperature to actually make these. So if all is equal, the nuclei actually would like to go here. But as I said, you need enough energy to actually, these are local minima of energy. So you need enough energy to be able to actually go there. So at high temperatures, you could do that. Low temperatures that the centers of the smaller stars, that never happens. Okay, so I guess a couple of more things about nuclear reactions is, so the typical Fermi energy, so we talked about basically this exclusion principle. So there's a typical Fermi energy that you already know how to calculate. You've done it for electrons. So Fermi energy is just Fermi momentum, or it's by definition is Fermi momentum squared divided by 2m. This is mass of nucleon. And the Fermi momentum is just given by the size of the, it's given by the size and the number density, if you remember. So Fermi momentum was just, what was it? How did it relate to number density? Anybody remember? Number density. You're closer before. 1/2. So what is de Broglie? What is de Broglie? What is it? Is it called de Broglie wavelength? No, it's. What is it called? If particle has a momentum, what is its wavelength? De Broglie wavelength. What is it? H bar over momentum. So if PF in terms of de Broglie wavelength is 1 over lambda. Okay. So this is de Broglie wavelength, or I guess, de Broglie wavelength. So, and of course, fermions have exclusion principle. They would then overlap. So this is what they had, like number density to the 1/3. Right? So this would be a nuclear number density, which is nuclear density divided by nuclear mass. So so this would be in natural units, this would be a over 2 to the power of 1/3 divided by size. because number density is the number of particles. A over 2 is, of course, indistinguishable particles. So you have A over 2 is the number of neutrons or protons, power of 1/3, divided by size cubed, of course, then with 1/3, just size. So this is it.
Size
of the atom. So this would be, so the size is also A to the 1/3, right? So this is a constant. Because the number density is constant, density of this is an incompressible droplet, right?
So is roughly 1/2 for everything.
Where is 1/2? Yeah, I didn't write. Well, it's 1/2 divided by whatever constants that sits there, because there is right. I mean, size is proportional to A to the 1/3. It's not exactly it. Right. So what you get is you get the Fermi energy. So for nuclear densities, you get the Fermi energy, we're just plugging this into here, which is of order 25 MeV. Right. And so the binding energy, we already calculated the maximum. Oh, I didn't write down the maximum. So maximum is 7 or 8 MeV roughly. So that's binding energy. This is the kinetic energy, basically. So the total energy, which is kinetic plus potential energy, is so it's sum of this, basically, 25 plus 8, which is 33, right? So potential a typical potential, this is the depth of a typical nuclear potential. Nucleus potential, let's say, nucleus is potential. So this means that basically this thing that I was plotting here, if you want to think of it as potential versus, say, distance, x, like you do in quantum mechanics, some point a large distance is asymptotes to a constant, and this difference between the minimum and basically the maximum is of order 33 MeV. At least for iron, that would be, I guess for other ones, it would be less than that. They're not quite as stable. OK, so that's a typical scale for atomic reactions as well. It's of order few MeV to tens of MeV. So that means, for example, if you have one of these transitions that you turn one of neutrons to protons, then you typically make electrons and neutrinos of that order energy. Because okay. I mean, that could vary by order of magnitude. Okay. In terms of kelvins, good. So how many kelvins is it? So 1 electron volt is. Is how many kelvins? 10,000 kelvin, 10 to the 4 kelvin. So MeV is 1,000,000 electron volt. So that's how many kelvin? 10 to the 10, 10 to the 33 MeV would be 10 to the 11 kelvin. So that's quite hot. It's much hotter than the center of the sun. What is the center of the sun? 10 to the 7 kelvin. So this is good because indeed this shows that, and this is something that we already discussed early in the course, that you cannot classically make. So for example, so let me just say one thing before getting there. So this would be a potential for a neutron, but of course for a proton there is an electrostatic repulsion if the proton wants to sit there. So if you want to draw potential approximately for a single particle, or effective potential for a single particle as a function of distance, there would be something that looks like this for a neutron. its own bound states. For a neutron. But then for a proton, you would have a potential barrier before getting down here, right? This would be for a proton. And this at large distances is just electrostatic repulsion, which is Z ES squared over R, what happens at large distances. So I guess if you want to do it, you probably it's better to set it to zero at, of course, you can always add a constant to this. It's probably better to set it to zero at large distances if you want to make it, because, right? So in quantum mechanics, you can always add a constant. It doesn't make a difference. Good. So that's actually interesting. So Coulomb force, you don't cut it off because it's a long range force, unless you're in a plasma and.
I don't mean the long range.
Yeah.
In the short range. So
oh, right. No. So what happens, and there is a finite size, right? So if you just want to take Coulomb force, it kind of caps off because it's not a point source anymore. It has a finite density. So just Coulomb force itself, cannot draw it here. It will be something that becomes like flat here. But then if you add this nuclear forces, they are short range, so they're going to basically drive this down. That part would be the same for neutrons and for protons. So, and I guess technically probably this minimum is not the same for protons and neutrons. So it probably brings it up a little. Right, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that would be the reason that, I mean, A and Z wouldn't be exactly the same because these energy levels aren't exactly the same. So if you try to minimize this whole thing, because of the electrostatic term, the minimum wouldn't be where Z equals A, depends on really the details. Okay, so this size is of order a few MeV. So this barrier, right, this of order, so this was 30 MeV that we were discussing. And this barrier, I guess, is of order, I've written Z1 times Z2 times MeV. So I guess that could be also quite big. Well, I guess it depends on what Zs are. Well, so depends, of course. Now, atoms would be more complicated. So the simplest thing would be if you just were wondering what happens if a proton comes in. So that would be for most relevant thing for nuclear fusion at the center of the sun, for example, because you want to fuse two protons. But the lesson here is that, as we said, the temperatures that you have isn't nearly enough to cross this because you need of order MeV temperature, which is 10 to the 10 Kelvin. And the center of the sun, you have 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So what you need to rely on is quantum tunneling, which you're all very familiar with now. And I guess I'm going to discuss that in a little bit. So that brings us to the topic of nuclear reactions, which is, of course, what's important if you want to make different nuclei. And as you know, that's how we can exist as human beings who are made out of nuclei. I guess we're made out of oxygen and carbon, some iron. I don't know what is it, water, I guess. But water is, I guess, oxygen, hydrogen. Hydrogen, it already exists in the universe, so you don't have to worry about that. But then everything else has to be made basically through nuclear reactions at the centers of the stars. So here, I mean, this is very complicated. I mean, probably just as complicated as chemistry. So it's really nuclear chemistry. Here, I'm just going to write down some basic properties, and let's see how far we can get.
Can we hear that these elements cannot be made on stars? What we are just saying that have a greater than iron, so they're heavier than iron.
Right. No, they can be made in the stars. They're just not right. They're not easily. So right. So what happens is depends on how much energy you have. So if you have high enough temperature, then you can make everything, because that's the thing about high temperature is that basically anything that can happen will happen, because as long as there's the finite finite transition rate.
So more or less, we, like, you could see higher things, but they would also fission down.
They would fission down, right? So energetically, they would prefer to be down here, right? But if you have high enough energy, you know the Boltzmann weight, right? So Boltzmann weight, you have number density goes as minus e to the minus energy divided by temperature, right? So if you are in thermal equilibrium at a high enough temperature, then of course you can make everything. Doesn't depend what the energy is. But then if you have low temperature, then you cannot really make it up here. You would just stay. Stay close to iron, and of course, the thing is that if you have very low temperatures, like at the center of the sun, then it's going to be exponentially hard to even get there because of this. Right? You can, in principle, make a lower energy if you can cross this barrier, but this barrier is high and it's higher for higher basically Z. So you can barely make it for proton, but you cannot make it for basically higher. Right. I mean, these are steps, you mean?
Yeah.
But that has to do with the fact that A is discrete.
Right.
Right. From a single. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Probably a single transition doesn't give you as much energy. That's true. Okay. Good. So let's just write a couple of basic properties. Or get us started with the basic properties of nuclear interactions. So a typical nuclear reaction. So, and I mean, it doesn't have to look like this, but this is like how most of these things look like. You have a lighter atomic nuclear. Well, you have a lighter particle. You have a heavy nucleon. So they collide. They make an unstable state. So basically, you have, say, for example, a proton that penetrates the barrier. So this guy penetrates Coulomb barrier. If it's charged, if it's not charged, I guess that would be, it could be a neutron. If it's a neutron, it doesn't have to penetrate the barrier because there is no barrier. But for everything, every other nucleus, because they are positively charged, they have to penetrate the barrier. Then combined with the other, with whatever nucleus that's sitting there, you have an unstable state, and it's going to decay to another particle plus another nucleus. Or this could be two nuclei in general. And this could be also the same as what came in. It could be A plus X, or it could be something else. And this is, so this is B leaves the barrier. So the reaction rate, this is just the definition. It's basically the number of reactions per unit time, per unit volume. It's just number density of A times number density of X times the average of sigma cross section times V function of for AB. Well, this is just definition of sigma V, if you will. T is time. This one? This is just number. Yeah, so it's a number of interactions per unit time, per unit volume. Okay. So if you have a unit volume, how many of these processes is going to happen within 1 second, for example? this would be, this is a definition of sigma v, so it's not something terribly deep. So in a sense, sigma v is defined via this relationship. And this is something that you can in general calculate in quantum mechanics. So this is something you would have done in maybe graduate quantum mechanics for some processes. It's like the last chapter of Sakurai, something like that. Right. And sigma VAB, and in general, you have to average this over the thermal distribution, because these A's and X's have a thermal spectrum, if it's a thermal plasma. Let's assume that. So can I fit this in here? The sigma VAB is just, if you just average over the Maxwellian, something that looks like this. T to the minus 3/2, an integral of sigma AB of energy, E to the minus E over T, and there's E dE. So this, you can recognize this is just Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is this guy, exponential of E to the minus ET at temperature T. And this is just integral over the phase space. So this would have been integral of Vs squared dV or Ps squared dP times velocity, because there is a velocity. The rate is proportional to cross-section times the velocity. And this sigma AB is just the cross-section as a function of energy. The cross-section of basically A coming in, B going out. So this here, I haven't done anything terribly deep. I've just written down an average over the thermal distribution, given that I know particles have different velocities. And this mass would be, in principle, this would be the reduced mass, I think. Or it could be the mass of the lighter particle. This m would be the reduced mass. Okay. Of course, this is what's responsible for why at low temperature it's going to be hard to have nuclear fusion, because you have a large barrier to penetrate.
So would that mean that the larger masses have a
smaller? Larger masses have a small, and that's something that we already learned. Like, for example, why we talk about electrons most of the time for like plasma physics, when we know. Because it's not the crop.
Yeah.
Well, right. So this does depend on what sigma is in general. But I mean, the point is that smaller masses are faster. So that's why there is a 1 over m here. That's the same temperature. And the generic form of sigma AB then has this form. And again, this is also definition. So we haven't really done much more than just defining things. So there is a pi lambda bar squared. This is just the Broglie wavelength. There's a g with some number of order 1, gamma a divided by gamma b divided by gamma, and then sum over r of gamma squared divided by e minus er squared. And this is a sum over resonances. So lambda bar is just, let me just write this down. This is just pi over p squared, which is pi over 2. ME, which is, these are only natural units. This is 0.7 divided by E MEV times Barnes divided by mu, where mu is a reduced mass, as I said, or in atomic units. This atomic weight. And Barn is what? Anybody knows what a barn is? What is a barn? Yes, and how big is it? Good. How did you remember that? Okay, good, good. Now that's good. Yes, the barn is actually smaller than an actual barn, but the reason it's called barn is apparently it's so big compared to weak cross section, or I guess this is a typical nuclear cross section, but I guess that you don't typically get a barn, you usually get a mini barn or something like that. So the idea is that if you get this a barn, it's a very, very big cross section. So let me just write this down. So let's just go over these. At some sense, these are the definitions. But in fact, this is a good formula close to resonances, and this should look familiar to you. This form is just the Lorentz form that we had before. So generically, quantum mechanical transitions close to resonances, they have this form. So basically, the resonances is where you're exciting. So any atom has certain energy levels, and if the incoming energy is basically enough to excite it to one of its energy levels, then you would be at one of these resonances. Of course, you could be far from the resonance, then this formula doesn't work. But if you're close to resonances, this is what you want. So this form actually comes from this is generic thing you can derive in quantum mechanics. So there's a reason for everything that appears here. So generically, you could show that the maximum cross section that you get, ER is one of the resonances. So it would be one of the transitions. It would be the difference between the energy levels. Like ER could be EM minus EN, basically two different, right? Like Lyman alpha that we had for an atom, for example, right? Right, so this structure, you could derive it from basically simple quantum mechanical considerations in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. For example, and this is not something I was planning to derive, but something that you could look up in, I guess, again, a standard textbooks. One of the things is at a resonance, the maximum cross-section is, and a maximum cross-section is always at a resonance for obvious reasons, because it's a resonance. And then at that point, the cross section is of order the de Broglie wavelength area. So this is the something generic you could show in quantum mechanics, that there's a maximum cross section just from unitarity properties of quantum mechanical system. And that is actually, you get close to that at the resonances. And that's basically, this is just a de Broglie wavelength. And that's how you get a barn. So the barn is basically the maximum cross-section you can get in nuclear interactions if you are at a resonance. And your energy is of order of MeV. So this G is some number order one that depends on the details of the transition. And these gamma ratios, so these gammas are decay rates of, so gamma itself is the sum over all gammas, gamma A's, let's say. So the idea is that this zeta star guy, it's an unstable state. It's going to decay to different things. Gamma A is decay rates to this guy. Gamma B is this decay rate to this guy. And basically, sum over all the decay rate to everything that can decay into is gamma. And I don't remember off the top of my head how this is derived, but these are just basic properties of quantum mechanical matrix elements if you do. This is time-dependent perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. You get something that generically looks like this for transition rates. Yes. So this is something I call like Fermi's Gordon rule. Yeah. Sorry, you were saying? We could, yeah, you could do it. No, I think that physically, I thought it would make sense because it shows you that at the resonance, you have basically your your cross section is a de Broglie wavelength. So that's, but yeah, you could, I think, different ways of writing this down. Another interesting thing is that basically this is set by the resonance itself. It doesn't depend actually on the decay product, where you're going, coming and where you're going. They just come out as prefactors. So this is these are generic. So this is how generic cross sections in nuclear physics look like. And basically, what you need to do is plug this into this formula for your star. And that gives you basically how often you expect any nuclear cross section. Anything else I need to mention given the time? I think it's 1:30. So let's try to finish the rest of this next week. So the next thing I'm going to do is, I was going to basically derive some typical nuclear reaction rates for resonant interactions like this and non-resonant interactions like how you make helium at the center of the sun. And that was it, basically. These are the two things I was going to do. So I'm going to do that next week. And I guess next week is the last, so we're going to have two more lectures. I'm going to finish up this nuclear astrophysics. And I'm going to do some stuff on high energy astrophysics, like cosmic rays and Fermi acceleration, things like you go even higher than nuclear energies, like GeV or TeV, etc. And that's it. And then we have our last tutorial on Friday. Thank you. Any questions? Nope. Okay. So, Britt, you weren't here yesterday. So we decided that December 12th was going to be our basic presentation day. It's a Friday. So I expect that you guys basically hand in your reports then. There will be a presentation about what you've done. And so if you haven't gotten it started, you should, because as I was saying, the last year it took a lot tough time from. students from last year were complaining that, well, the supervisor of students from last year were complaining that they couldn't get any research done because they were working on this project. So should get it started. Well, so you get the idea is that you're given a problem, you should solve it. So as much as it takes. If you could solve it in two and then describe your solution in 2 pages, good. If it takes 17 pages, then. right. So this is your research problem. And I guess you got 20. Well, you got how many days? Less than 20 days to do it. Well, 21 days. So you got 3 weeks to do it. Okay. Right. So I once wrote a paper in 2 days. So so it's possible. It wasn't a very long paper. So I